Welcome to Common Thread. We hope you find these lessons helpful, but also we'd like to get to know you. If you go to our website /newcomer, we'll send you an email, some things to read about the community, and an invitation to a personal chat. If you're here in Raleigh, maybe face-to-face. If not, on Zoom. We hope you will. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. Okay, here's the lesson. It's a way of asking ourselves about the small things that we do or that we don't do that accumulate, and over time either pull our lives forward or pull us back. Last week, we started looking at a kind of prayer, the praying for kind of prayer, asking ourselves, is there any value in this practice? It was that way of asking, am I doing it right? Is there any value in it? Because I said, I know that a lot of us in our community have stopped praying for. We do other forms of prayer, but we don't do the praying for prayer, and maybe for good reason, because we explored this last week, this kind of prayer, imagining it in a way that many people do, imagining God as a deity out there somewhere, existing far from us, and so consequently praying for becomes a way of getting to God to get God to act on someone else's behalf. So I say the prayer, God decides, then after God decides, God acts or doesn't act. And we said no matter what God decides in this imagined scenario, not great, because we either get a mafia boss God or we get a heartless God or we get a weak God. That notion of prayer we saw diminishes the divine, but at the same time bolsters the ego as self. So if you missed, you can check that out on the podcast. But I also suggested in what honestly is a whole lot of bathwash, maybe there's a baby. Because the idea that there's a kernel of goodness that makes the pray for concept actually be a good thing in the first place, that might be worth exploring. I mentioned last week our long-standing pattern. We've done a lot of work deconstructing our religious stories and our religious wisdom and our religious practices, and then reconstructing them as well. And as we've done that, we've always started with the assumption that an ancient thing is an ancient thing, and it became an ancient thing because at some point it touched something deeply human inside of us. And if we do the typical thing when we run into a toxic religious practice, the typical thing being to jettison the whole thing altogether, we can actually impoverish ourselves by throwing out the toxic parts, of course, but also throwing out what was the good thing that made the thing into a thing in the first place. We're better served, has been our starting assumption, if we strip the thing down. And boy, let me tell you, the stripping down work can be very emotionally difficult. But if we strip the thing down, find the core kernel, and then rebuild on that. Now, what I didn't mention last week, spiritual people have spiritual experiences. I sure have. I bet you have too. But after we strip down our stories, the stories that we tell ourselves about God or about human nature, when we strip our stories down, and particularly when we strip down the story that we told ourselves about the spiritual experience, the story that we framed that spiritual experience inside, when the story goes away, it often feels like the experience itself is also no longer valid. No longer hold on to a ball. So sometimes we let go of both the story, but also the experience. And that's kind of a tragedy because the experiences were kind of the point. Because we don't see this updating our story, our meaning-making narratives, is an integral part of being human. We do it all the time in our daily lives. Constantly updating the stories we tell ourselves. We do it historically in our religious life all the time. Constant updating of how we imagine God throughout history. Constant updating of how we imagine human nature. Constant updating of how we imagine what is sin, what constitutes salvation. All the parts of our religious narratives, we go historically through a constant updating process. But we don't see that that's happening. And consequently, we might miss the point because it turns out that our spiritual experiences are not really derived from our stories. It actually goes the other way around. What happens is we tell meaning-making stories in order to try and make meaning of the experiences that we have. The experiences are the engine. The meaning-making story is the caboose that follows along behind the engine, but it is the experience that is driving the process. So consequently, when we do the work that we as a community have been doing to update our stories, that's kind of an essential process for the spiritual life. Because if we don't update our stories, we end up abandoning the experiences, and that turns out being very harmful to the spiritual life. Updating our meaning-making stories is how we keep, even how we expand, our access to our own spiritual experiences. Now, last week, if you're online, I hope you talked about these questions at home, but here in the room we did, and we did some work exploring our experiences around this praying for practice. And it turns out, for all the toxic stuff that we talked about last week, and there was plenty of it, there was also plenty of positive spiritual experience that happened in this praying for context. And there was a little bit of grief that we had let it go. Because when we lost it, what we lost was a normalized way of having camaraderie in our difficult times. To pray for one another was a way that we connected to each other around our troubles. We lost a way of being community together during tough times. We lost some norms and some language that made it easy to talk about things that people tend to not talk about. But when we were at church, we could actually talk about that under the rubric, "Will you pray for me?" We lost a way to say out loud painful stuff, difficult stuff, stuff that tends not to come up in day-to-day conversation, but has been part of normal conversation in church life or spiritual community life. We could do that at church. We could have those kinds of conversations at church. We could do it in the context of spiritual community, and we lost that. Praying for gave us language and gave us norms and gave us permission to talk about hard stuff, to stand with each other, to comfort one another in the midst of our challenges, be with one another. And we had a whole set of language and norms and practices to do that. That normalized us being able to face our troubles together. But there's a second thing that the practice gave us. The practice gave us language and norms for bringing our troubles into the space where we seek to encounter the divine. Troubles, you might have noticed this, are troubling. And when troubles are troubling, it's hard to see anything else except the trouble. It's certainly hard to see some abstract idea like, let me seek out the divine in the midst of my trouble. But praying for one another helped remind us to seek something bigger than our troubles, to seek something higher, something truer, something more noble. It was a way that we encouraged one another to look for the divine in the midst of our challenging moments. Praying for gave us the impetus, helped remind us to search, to seek, to quest, to stand with one another, to encourage one another, to find divine light in our times of darkness. So both of those, having a normalized communal way to be with one another in our troubles, having a normalized communal way of encouraging one another to seek something bigger when we're in our troubles, those are pretty precious things to give up. So our question today is, do we have to? We sure can't keep praying for the way that I described praying for last week. But could another meaning-making story restore what is potentially a very precious practice to us? Well, that's today's lesson. Okay, afterwards, these are the questions that we're going to be talking about. As we are reimagining a story about praying for, the question is, what works for you? But probably more important is the second question, what doesn't work for you? Where does resistance come up for you? What is hard for you to get your head around? What's hard for you to respond to experience? And then looking forward to what could happen as we begin to figure out new norms, some rough draft ideas of if we were to pray for, in the context of this everything is connected worldview, what would that look like? What might be some new rough draft ideas about new language and new norms and new practices? So that's to give you some time to be thinking as we're going through the lesson, be thinking about those questions. Okay. Now let's see if we can reimagine our praying for story. Remember where we started? I pray to God, God decides, then God acts. And in that framework, in essence, God works for me. I am the initiator. I am the catalyst. I'm the one who gets things going. Now, here's the thing. That dynamic, that there is an initiator, there is a catalyst, that is how things work. Somebody initiates something. That's how stuff happens. Something happens because somebody initiated it. So that's an important story, but maybe not the right story for this notion of praying for. I said last week that today was going to get a little bit weird. Here's the weird. It's the quantum superpositioning kind of weird. It's the spooky action at a distance kind of weird. I want to remind you of a recurring theme that you hear a lot at Common Thread. Get ready for it. Everything is connected. You hear that? Everything is connected. Or another way we say it is oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. Oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. You hear that all the time. And it goes back to the mystics in our tradition who initiated the concept a long time before our physicists figured it out. But here's the thing. Now our physicists have figured it out. And what was once a pushed out to the fringe part of our spiritual tradition is becoming, actually has to become, our mainstream narrative about the spiritual journey, the spiritual life. Now, that full transition hasn't happened yet, but we're probably at the early adopter stage. We're not to the early mainstream stage, but we're at the early adopter stage. Now, for some, this concept that oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness, it'll just freak them out. Because for some, rooted in the Newtonian worldview, oneness gets associated with things that we've kind of treated as taboo. Things like tarot cards and the psychic network. It kind of goes into that category. But in fact, oneness has long been the bedrock of our spiritual tradition. Not just ours, other spiritual traditions. We just didn't like it. And the reason we didn't like it was because it didn't jive with, it didn't mesh with the worldview that we live in. We lived in a two-ness worldview, so the concept that our mystics were talking about oneness just didn't make sense. Now, we could imagine, point to the drawing right there, we could imagine that image. That worked with our worldview. Here is me, a separate and discrete package. Here is God, a separate and discrete package. And here is you, a separate and discrete package. And that works in our minds when we live in Newton's world. One of Jesus' most well-known prayers was a oneness prayer. Slightly less well-known than his most well-known prayer, which felt decidedly a two-ness prayer, our Father out there, not here. That seems a very two-ness prayer. That's the one that gets all the press. But we get a lot of our understanding of two-ness from another prayer. It's in John 17. You should read it. It's a little longer. It's a little less memorize it for Sunday. It doesn't get as much attention, but basically it's the prayer that Jesus prays for us that we would, you and I, awaken to our oneness with God. And that we would, you and I, awaken to our oneness with one another. That we are all part of this connected, interconnected reality. Again, it's a good prayer. You should read it sometime. Everything is connected is a notion that predated Jesus. It is a notion that post-dated Jesus, and it's been a bedrock understanding of all the spiritual traditions, not just our own. And the idea says something like this. You and I are not the bounded sets of separateness that we feel like we are. I've said this many times. I can move my arm. I can't move Kate's arm. So it feels like I am separate from Kate. But we are actually carriers of the same essence. We are bound together in the same fabric of being. It feels like we're separate. That's why we get the circles here. But if we think more deeply and if we delve more deeply, we find out that there's an open part to the circle. So, in a very real way, we are connected to one another, much more so than we tend to intuit. Part of you is part of me. Every one of us, Paul said, is a member of every other one of us. I think we've got that up on the wall, yeah. Every one of us connected to one another. But here's the thing, maybe also, every one of us connected to everything. So, our mystics told us then, and now our physicists are telling us now, that you and I are more one with everything than we are two. Separate and discrete from everything works in our brains, but it's not necessarily true. To use Paul's language again, you and I, we feel like we are a foot, or we feel like we are a hand, and we feel like our footness, our handness, is the whole picture. That's what it feels like inside of us. But we are, in fact, connected to a larger body. Our footness is connected to something bigger, to bodiness. Everything is interconnected, not separate, as our brains so often fool us into thinking. We feel like we were separate, but that is not indicative of the reality we live in. Now, if there is a greater reality, and it is worthy of the word divine, it does not exist out there in Plato's realm of forms, disconnected and far away from you and me. The notion of our Father who art in heaven, out there, it's only a metaphor. And it's a metaphor for talking about the divine in one way, seen from one angle. But, as all metaphors do, it breaks down over time, including the one that we're going to talk about right now. It's going to break down eventually. We only have metaphors for speaking about that which is bigger than we can contain. But if we use this particular metaphor that I'm going to talk about now, it might help us rediscover how we can pray for. So, there is a greater reality, and that greater reality is in us, this metaphor would go. There is a greater reality, and we are in it, this metaphor would go. Carriers of the inner light, every one of us. Carriers of divine breath, every one of us. Do you hear that from time to time? An integrated connection with the divine and an integrated connection with one another, more one than two, everything connected, this is the reality that the mystics intuited a long time ago and the physicists are now explaining is the way it is. Now I know that sounds weird, but I want you to know it only sounds weird because we're not used to it. It sounds weird because we're not used to it. It doesn't sound weird because it's untrue. It just sounds weird because of when we were born. We were born into this historical moment, and in this historical moment, our collective language, our collective understanding about reality, our collective norms and practices have not yet caught up to how we are coming to understand the nature of the things in which we live. We're in this in-between time where that concept just feels weird. So that makes it all the more amazing that our mystics intuited this a long time before we even had physicists. Before we had Einstein, before we knew about quantum weirdness, we already had people who intuited that this is the nature of things, more one than two. One with the divine, one with the inner light, carriers of that light, one with one another. And the thing is, they intuited it when their worldview was telling them that's not even possible. So, pretty amazing. Thank you, mystics. But even so, even though we have Einstein, even though we have quantum superpositioning, even though we understand things that we didn't, entanglement, things that we didn't know about, we have them. It still feels non-intuitive to imagine that we are more one than two. It's still non-intuitive to imagine that the world and ourselves and each other and God are part of a connected whole. And it's because it's still pretty non-intuitive that it's difficult to imagine praying for, because that just does feel weird. But here's the thing. It's different, and it feels weird, but as meaning-making narratives go, that is much closer to the way we are coming to understand reality. So if we could get more familiar with, if we could get more comfortable with, everything is connected. If we could get more familiar with, if we could get more comfortable with, oneness is a better description. Then we could begin to imagine rituals like maybe extending our hand towards someone like we do at the end of the service, and imagine that we had normalized language for calling forth the divine that is within one another already. That could be our praying for. We could imagine practices that we were used to that didn't any longer feel weird, in which we were calling out what is good and what is healing, the deepest parts of one another that is in one another, where one another are able to access their own divine centers and call that forth. That could become a normalized way of praying for. We could begin to imagine gathering with our spiritual community and gathering with our spiritual friends and having a time dedicated to the practice of, and a place that we went when we did the practice of, and the development of tried and true practices that people figured out over time that would really work for us to call out the inner capacity for wisdom for one another when we're in times of confusion. To call out the inner capacity for healing when we are in times of harm. To call out the inner capacity for grace in a moment of resentment. Because I say inner capacity, but what it says is every one of us is a carrier of divine breath. The Spirit of God is within us. I'm going to introduce you to a book next week. You might want to get a head start. It's called Integral Christianity. The author's name is Smith. And he's going to present to you three ways in which we can think about praying. We can pray to God, we can pray with God, and this is the freak out part, we can pray as God. We can pray as drawing from the divine center that is within us, the deep within us calling to the deep and calling it forth. So imagine that we were working with and familiar with a different idea about where God is. Instead of thinking that God is out there where Plato put God, we begin to imagine God within, integrated into. How might we pray for? Imagine we think differently about what it means to be human. Instead of having at the core center of who we are ugly, ugly sin consciousness, we are carriers of the interior light, every one of us. How might we call that forth and pray for? What does it mean to be a divine center wrapped in an ego shell as opposed to being ugly sin consciousness with the milk of human kindness? What does it mean when we reimagine who we are and how that would implicate how we imagine praying for? How might we pray for when we are calling out the inner light that is in each of us, the deepest, the most authentic, the divine center? How might we get comfortable working with everything is connected? Now, here's our problem again. Come on up, Lindsay. We live in a moment where we have not yet collectively internalized that oneness framework. We just do. That's not going to go away. It's not going to stop feeling weird. But because it feels weird, we haven't yet worked out the language and the practices that would work within that framework. So we can't pray for in the old framework anymore. We've already stopped doing that. And we haven't yet figured out how to pray for in the new one because it just feels strange. So we don't know what it looks like. We don't know what we might say. But once we do figure that out, once we build new language and new norms and new practices on top of a more helpful meaning-making narrative, maybe we could both meet the deep human need that happens when we pray for, but also remain integrated with our emerging view of reality. So yeah, right now, it either feels inauthentic or it feels weird. It does. But that makes our job, the job of our generation, to figure out the new norms, the new language, to think about them, to test them, to do new trial runs, and to feel the weirdness, but then chart a way through the weirdness so that others later don't have to feel the weirdness and don't have to give up the kernel of goodness when they walk away because it seems so inconsistent. And we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, but during our What Are You Thinking time, here's what I want us to be thinking about. That diagram suggests a way forward. When we think about the divine in you and we think about the divine in me, it suggests some language that might come for praying for. Words like calling up, words like calling forth, words like calling out, or ideas like affirming the inner light that's in there, but it so easily gets covered under our fear or our anxiety. It seems like we could find words in this new framework. So, indwelling divine. May we draw from our whole heritage and find the goodness in and draw more deeply from the interior light. Amen. This is the other song that Lindsay found. I thought it was great for us. May you find the light.
We'd love to connect with you in real life. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. And if you'd like to take an ownership stake in the well-being of the community, we all contribute online. You'll find a donate button at the top of our website. See you next time. We'd love to connect with you in real life. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. And if you